easily knocked off the Minnesota Vikings 38-7 for the NFC title. Super Bowl set for February 4th in Minneapolis. NBA, Bucks and Bulls off last night. Tonight, Bucks host Phoenix. The Bulls are in New Orleans. NHL, the Blackhawks host Tampa Bay. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, January 22nd. Dense fog advisory in effect till 9 a.m. Cloudy and foggy with rain and possible thunderstorms off and on throughout the day today, a high of 49. Right now, wind from the east northeast at 8. It's raining. Areas of fog, 40 degrees Kenosha, 38 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackanddrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. And honestly, I can't think of a better way to begin the week than with Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and also responsible for a column that is published in newspapers both here and abroad, and a monthly visitor to the morning show. And it's hard to imagine what a month would be like without a visit from Dr. Art Sear, who offers his reflections on any number of different and important topics. And we have lots of different things that we're going to be talking about today. We'll be looking back over this first 12 months of the presidency of Donald Trump. We'll talk about this partial government shutdown in which we find ourselves at the moment. There have been interesting developments on the Korean Peninsula that we will talk about. Brexit continues to be in the news. And at the end of the hour, I'm going to be asking Professor Sear to say a few words about a radio legend in Chicago by the name of Milt Rosenberg, who for many, many years presided over a fascinating late-night program that aired over WGN. And Professor Sear was a frequent guest on the program of Milt Rosenberg, who recently died.
An occasional guest.
And occasionally.
You're entirely too generous this morning, but that's a fact that, occasionally.
Occasionally. Well, be that as it may, you had the pleasure of being a guest on his program, so we'll give you a chance at the end of the hour to say a few words about the legendary Milt Rosenberg. But in the meantime, we welcome you to this humble program, Professor Art Sear. Glad to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Greg. Thank you for the kind words. Good-hearted person you are.
So let's begin, if we may, with essentially the same topic with which we spent a whole hour on Friday with one of our faculty colleagues, Professor Jerry Mast, talking about the first 12 months of the Donald Trump presidency since Saturday marked exactly the one-year anniversary of his inauguration. We don't have the whole hour to talk about this. We have lots of things to get to. But I just wonder, as we pass the one-year mark, first of all, I guess one of the questions I would be most interested in hearing you talk about is if these 12 months have been surprising for you, or has the Donald Trump presidency, in a sense, largely aligned with what you expected or predicted it would be?
Well, I didn't know what to expect. And as I've mentioned before in your program, I don't want to overdo it, but I didn't think he could get nominated or elected. So that shows how good I am at predicting the future. In terms of the administration, I felt great uncertainty. And I've been reassured that things have been more stable than they might have been, believe it or not, despite all the furor in the media.
What would you say have been the ways in which, let's say, our political life has functioned differently under a Trump presidency? Or is it functioning largely the same way, and just the specifics are different?
I think long-term trends have continued. He tweets a great deal. He talks a great deal. All politicians do. Historically, at the presidential level, presidents are generally more discreet publicly. That was expected in earlier, less crude times, in my from my biased perspective. And a great deal of calculation goes into politics. One reason why he's so popular with a certain share of our fellow citizens is that he's so spontaneous. He hasn't actually done much as president. And I think from my, again, biased perspective, I think that's all to the good. But he so far does not seem to be a strong chief executive. The initial chaos in the White House has been brought considerably under control. And I think a lot of credit goes especially to John Kelly, the retired four-star Marine general, who has clearly imposed some order there in the kindergarten.
One of the aspects of Donald Trump that made him attractive to at least many of the people who ultimately voted for him is the fact that he is this businessman who has enjoyed some very splashy successes over the years, and the thought was that a businessman could bring something very valuable to the presidency, and maybe in a sense running the country like it's a business, or approaching the challenges of leadership as a businessman might be really advantageous versus somebody who's a career politician or a lawyer or whatever. As someone who I think understands the world of business and business people very well, does that remain a valid possibility?
I would not describe him as a businessman. It's very important to the president to be seen as a businessman. George Herbert Walker Bush was undeniably a successful business entrepreneur. Jimmy Carter, believe it or not, was successful at business, the family business, which he, I believe, rescued from some considerable trouble. Herbert Hoover was a successful businessman. None of the three is generally considered to be a really great president. In the case of President Trump, he's a show businessman. He lost a great deal of money. His father was a very successful, brilliantly successful New York and New Jersey real estate entrepreneur who, according to the available record, went to great lengths to try to rein in that particular son so that the family fortune would not be destroyed. But I wouldn't describe him as a business executive or a business entrepreneur. But he was enormously successful in show business. And I don't think anyone, certainly not a professor like me sitting here, however generously introduced, should minimize that. I thought he was finished in the 80s. I don't want to demean myself too much because we don't want everybody to turn off the program. But after he faded, after making lots of splashes in the Northeast Coast real estate scene and having some, like today, some colorful press about his personal behavior and antics. I thought he was finished, but he came back in the media and then went from there to the White House. Quite extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. You've already talked about how your abilities to predict the future are, well, let's just say limited, as they are for just about all of us. But
his last appearance on the morning show.
Right. But nevertheless, I am particularly curious to have you say what you think might be ahead in this second year of a Donald Trump presidency. As far as you can tell, is it likely to be similar to the first year, or are there signs that you've already talked about how Kelly's presence in the White House is a stabilizing factor.
And others, but I mean, it's clearly a sea change as soon as he appeared, and something had to happen.
Right.
The operation was going to survive at all. The ongoing investigation of Russian involvement in the U.S. generally and making mischief in the 2016 election, that could turn into a major controversy. If the polls are right, this November should be very favorable to Democrats. And I think if they take over the House, I believe the Senate will be a lot harder, but if they take over one or both houses of the Congress, there'll be a big change in the atmosphere. It'll become even more intense, even more partisan, probably even more ugly. On the other hand, the president has demonstrated that he wears political coats of many colors, depending on the circumstances and his mood, and he was not a Republican until he became one a short time ago. He was much more affiliated and associated with Democrats, including the Clintons. He's very much a product of the Northeast and metropolitan New York, which is Democratic Party territory. He's made a couple of moves early on during the first year to work with the Democrats, and who knows, he may turn out to be a great deal maker, which he has not demonstrated yet, but I think it'll be very interesting. And that's an important part of politics, being interesting. And he's interesting to a lot of people. And he clearly dominates the media. Look what we're discussing this morning. Perhaps we might move on to something else
at some point. Well,
but he's succeeded in what he wanted, nonstop attention. And the hostility that a lot of the media, especially public radio and the public broadcasting system, devote to him only feeds his support among the people who are really committed to him.
Well, we, of course, find ourselves in the midst of a partial government shutdown.
Yes.
and a real impasse on Capitol Hill. And it appeared that some sort of deal had been brokered only for that deal to, in fact, fall apart. And there have been all kinds of efforts to cobble something together that could, if nothing else, keep the government fully functioning in the short term, in the very short term, but thus far all for naught. First of all, help us understand what it really means when the government shuts down in the way that it is shut down at the moment. What really are the consequences of that? And how serious is a situation like this?
It's very serious for the people who usually pay the price, that is the women and men who do the work of our economy and our nation and our government. Thousands and thousands of federal workers, the vast majority dedicated people, just like most people, are dedicated to doing a good job. We're told over the weekend, or being told today, don't come to work, go home. Only what's considered essential people. This has happened so much. We've had more than a dozen government shutdowns starting in the 1980s.
Really?
Yeah, and it's happened so much that agencies and departments are prepared. But what's particularly unattractive to me, when big-time, ambitious, egocentric politicians do their routines to get attention and try to generate support among their own bases, it's the average man and the average woman who pays the price, and that's certainly happening now. In terms of you and me and our listeners, the mail will continue to be delivered. People will continue to get their Social Security checks. And in terms of people outside their government, there won't be any immediate effect. But if this goes on for any length of time, it will become very, very painful. Our military at the beginning of February will stop being paid, which is just disgusting and disgraceful to me as a person as well as a citizen. If it goes on for any length of time, it's going to turn into a real atrocity, believe me. Wow. But it won't go on. It won't go on because the people won't stand for that.
Right, right. It would not be in anybody's interest to allow it to go to that. But I thought it was interesting. A commentator on Morning Edition today was basically saying there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around here. both sides of the aisle in Congress and President Trump, for that matter, in terms of things that have been said in the past about government shutdowns and what causes them and what makes them disgraceful and so on. I mean, everybody has ink on their hands when it comes to this.
Hypocrisy, young man. Please define that. It relates specifically to a couple of previous presidents. To give you a more specific answer, my understanding of the history is that Richard Nixon was so aggressive, to say something not so complimentary for a change about President Nixon, he was impounding funds, which has happened since Thomas Jefferson, but he did it on such a large scale, and he was so directly combative to Congress that they decided to change and make more rigorous, in effect, and more clear the budgetary process. In the past, we had muddled through, like our good British friends tend to do, and which is a good way to operate in politics, but it became a much more specific and much more explicit budgetary process. And then Jimmy Carter, for the best of reasons, as usual, and with the best of intentions, asked his attorney general, Mr. Cipolletti, to issue a legal opinion on whether or not the executive branch could spend money that had not yet formally been appropriated. And the attorney general wrote, "No, Mr. President, we can't do that." And that set the stage, as I understand the history, for shutdowns. I think it's unfortunate that happened. Republicans have continued to, as well as Democrats, respect that that change in established procedure. I think it would be worthwhile for some really daring politician, perhaps a president at some point, to challenge that legally and take it up to the Supreme Court, because I don't think it's been a plus for our system.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting history. The budget is crucial, and how we handle our finances collectively says a lot about us, and obviously we're not doing so well right now.
Right, right, and a lot of people shaking their heads in frustration and so on. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it reinforces an image of weakness and incompetence. That's not an overstatement. That feeds the confidence of our rivals and opponents, including Mr. Putin and Russia, and disappoints our friends and allies. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, and a monthly visitor to The Morning Show, offering his thoughts on various matters both here and abroad. You briefly mentioned Britain at some point, and I think it would be really interesting at this moment to talk a little about a recent column of yours in which you talked about kind of the ongoing saga of Brexit and the real political turbulence that is taking place in Britain right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was interesting in this column as I read it is I realized that I really don't understand the British political system probably as well as I should. And you talk in particular about how there has often been a real political ruthlessness in the political system there, and it is a real brass knuckles kind of business sometimes. And in some ways, maybe it's either become more so, or maybe we are really seeing that play out even maybe more clearly over the turbulence stirred up by the vote for Britain to leave the European Union. What are some of the ways in which the landscape in Britain right now is particularly turbulent and tense?
I don't think it's particularly turbulent and tense. it's a more public system. All politics is ruthless at some level and takes intense commitment. I had the great good fortune to live in Britain for a year when I was a graduate student working on my PhD dissertation, obviously many years ago. It was a life-changing experience for me, all to the good. And I was very fortunate. It was unusual for students to, even at a well-endowed university like the one I was attending, it was unusual, especially for undergraduates, to travel overseas. And now, what do we have? We have undergraduates, Carthage College, at least a dozen student groups with faculty supervision go overseas, almost everywhere, except for Burma and North Korea and a couple of other places, hot areas in the Mideast.
Right.
They literally travel everywhere, and it's so very, very positive. It really is in ways that I think we don't really appreciate. Anyway, I spent a lot of time sitting around the House of Commons, and I even sat around the House of Lords because it was so interesting. I was working on political themes. It was very easy to get a pass, and security was quite light. That long ago, the IRA started getting back into action, unfortunately, just before I left Britain, and things changed dramatically. But the debate was so intense and so public, and the hostility was so ferocious that I found it endlessly fascinating.
Mm.
And it really is an intensely partisan system. We're partisan, too, in this country. There is an emphasis on the quality of debate, quick-wittedness and cleverness that's different from our system. And if you want to get ahead in Britain, you've got to be able to excel in that environment, as Tony Blair did, for example, brilliantly, as Margaret Thatcher did in a less spectacular way, and unfortunately Theresa May finds herself in that intense environment. So far, she's unfortunately been rather deficient.
I remember a colleague a number of years ago, this is probably a quarter of a century ago maybe, saying that on this fairly new channel called C-SPAN, I mean fairly new then, that at certain hours of the day one could watch these sessions that would occur with the Prime Minister, and I think that was with the House of Commons.
Yes, question time. The Lords has some residual power, but it's the House of Commons where governments are formed and the action takes place, and it is a unified, monolithic system. They don't have our institutional separation of powers. The Prime Minister emerges from the Parliament. Mm. The monarch, currently Queen Elizabeth, is technically in charge of government and has some influence, but it all really comes from the Commons with some influence by the Lords.
Right. And it's a fascinating thing to watch.
It is.
And every so often I'll tune in if I can, but the Prime Minister is right there and in fairly close quarters. I mean, and it always appears that every seat is filled.
Yeah.
Unlike in our own U.S. Congress, where often people are standing up giving beautiful speeches and most of the
there.
Seats are empty. Yeah.
But the real work is done behind the scenes.
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah. But anyway, in these question times, the questions are fired at the Prime Minister, who will speak, and then fierce rebuttals will emerge, and he has to try to field these rebuttals or countermanding questions, and it's really something. Is that part of what you're saying in terms of the transparency of their process?
The intensity. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes there, too, but debate is much more public, and you have to excel in it. Lyndon Johnson was enormously powerful in the U.S. Congress and in Washington, and he was an enormously powerful president, partly because of the circumstances, Kennedy's assassination, but partly because of his own legislative brilliance. But he was not particularly impressive on television. He was not a great debater, but as a behind-the-scenes wheeler-dealer and deal-maker. He's a larger-than-life version of the kind of politician who tends to do well long-term in our system.
Hmm. So specifically to Britain and the matter that you were writing about in your column over Brexit, it sounds like Prime Minister Theresa May, in having to broker some kind of government, is having to reach out to a party actually based in Northern Ireland, if I understand correctly.
Right.
What makes this such a kind of dramatic moment?
Well, the two main parties, Conservatives and Labour, and before Labour, into the 20th century. It was the Liberal Party, now the Liberal Democrats. Two large parties have dominated the scene in Britain. Since the 50s and 60s, there's been a long-term decline in their dominance, and we've had the first coalition government since World War II, the unusual circumstances that where Churchill was the all-party leader. We've had a conservative liberal Democrat coalition between 2010 and 2015, and David Cameron governed, the conservative prime minister governed very effectively and then outsmarted himself. He decided to have a referendum, which is hardly unprecedented but unusual in Britain, on continued membership in the European Union. And lo and behold, the government lost. He treated the Liberal Democrats quite ruthlessly, in my view. And after winning a majority on his own in 2015, the Conservatives had a bare majority. He decided to have this referendum to solidify power and lost. In 2017, he resigned immediately, which is how their system works. Theresa May emerged from, I believe, a three-way leadership contest, and has so far proven remarkably ineffective as prime minister. She also rolled the dice and had a snap election in 2017 to get a large majority, not a narrow one. Polls indicated that would probably happen, but lo and behold, the conservatives lost their majority. So they can only, they don't have a coalition government, but they have a more informal agreement with a right-wing intensely Catholic, very conservative, intensely Protestant, I beg your pardon, very conservative small party in Northern Ireland, which gives them the bare majority that they need. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there's a lot of pressure within the system because she seems to be going down in all kinds of ways to either renegotiate, either have another referendum, or a change in terms of the stance toward Europe. A number of MPs, including MPs from Scotland, which wants to stay in the European Union, and from England, and conservative MPs went to Brussels last week, going around the prime minister to talk about how we might work things out so that we don't have to have a Brexit, which is a short-term shorthand reference for leaving the EU.
And we all wait and wonder how that's all going to play out. We also should mention on the topic of political turbulence that someone you greatly admire, Angela Merkel, in Germany, is facing tougher headwinds than she has in recent years. Are you thinking? I'm guessing you're hoping that she will weather some of these pressures.
Well, I believe she's put together yet another big coalition with the Social Democratic Party, the fourth that she's run. And you're right to bring up Germany. It's an extremely important country. It is the leader in continental Europe. And she has been probably the longest-serving German chancellor, certainly one of them. And has weathered lots and lots of storms. She's under a lot of pressure within her own party because primarily of her very humane as well as humanitarian liberal policies towards welcoming refugees, something that drives a lot of people and not just older Germans up the wall and creates tremendous anxiety in the people, especially the conservative base on which she's most dependent. Quite a great leader in my view. And a very strong person in the internal dynamics of that system, which Britain does not have at the moment. The British are also historically very ambiguous and always have been about the continent. So this current political turmoil is nothing new.
We're speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. Clausen, distinguished professor of political economy and world business.
Quite right. Thank you so much. I love titles.
Yeah, I've been so.
But that one wasn't my idea.
Right. I've been so anxious to. I've been so anxious to speak with you about events in the Korean Peninsula, and I think it caught a lot of people by surprise when I mean, mostly what we've been hearing about, of course, are the ominous threats from North Korea involving their nuclear capabilities and so on, and lots of fears about the upcoming Olympic Games in South Korea. And then lo and behold, comes this, what would seem to be a gesture of friendship from North Korea, and ultimately an agreement brokered for North Korea to actually be a part of these games, and even so much as I can't remember now what kind of a team, but there'll be some kind of a team that will actually be comprised of both North and South Koreans competing under kind of a neutral unification flag of some sort. I mean, as far as I could tell anyway, it's quite an extraordinary and completely unexpected development. Yeah. I'm just curious what you thought of all that, and if this came as much of a surprise to you as it, I think, did to most of the rest of us.
Yeah, it's surprising. It's reassuring. I think it's positive. I certainly think the U.S. should be encouraging cooperation between North and South Korea. The Koreans very much would like unification. No one else among the powers in the region or beyond, I think, is really anxious to have that. I think it would create a lot of problems for everyone. But in terms of collaboration, it's all to the good, especially in the wake of this long-term, extended, hysterical, nonstop propaganda from Pyongyang, emanating first and foremost from the great leader and Kim, and their steadily expansion of nuclear weapons capabilities. Yeah, it's all to the good. It is their peninsula, and we Americans, in my opinion, tend to assume that we should be involved in everybody else's business. We don't do that as readily as we did before the Vietnam War, but I think especially since the Cold War, we should be encouraging others, and it's all to the good, especially with the current president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, for them to be taking these initiatives. And I think it's important for us to remind ourselves that it's their peninsula. We should support them. They're our most important ally in many ways, in lots of different dimensions. But it's their peninsula.
What did you mean when you said that, in terms of reunification, that that's something that I think you said Koreans want? Is that what
yeah,
you said?
Yeah, I think North and South Koreans are very much interested.
So,
in that.
So you,
unlike Germany, unlike Vietnam, they don't have a history of great division. They had about 1,000 years of basic unity, and then more or less independence. They had to get along with the Chinese and the Japanese and even the Russians, but they were basically independent and cohesive, and then they were dependent during the terrible and brutal occupation by Japan from early in the 20th century until 1945, and then they were divided. But it's a very unusual phenomenon historically.
So it's, in a sense, a very artificial division.
Yes, indeed,
division
that's the term, artificial. But it's now, it's artificial, but it's quasi-permanent now.
Right. Can you just say a quick word about the circumstances under which that division took place? I assume that that took place in the as the Second World War ended.
Yeah.
So what were the circumstances under which that division took place?
Joseph Stalin was a very tough negotiator, a very disciplined individual, in great contrast, for instance, to Hitler. It's one reason he survived a lot longer. It's undeniable, drove very hard bargains with everyone, including the Allies during World War II, the other Allies, but he always stuck to the conditions that he agreed to. The Soviets bore the brunt of the fighting in Europe in World War II. Our own contribution is not to be minimized, or the other Western allies, but FDR and Churchill were very mindful of the fact that approximately 8 Soviet soldiers, military people, were being killed for every American or Brit who was being killed in that horrible war. The Red Army paid a huge price for taking Berlin, and then they withdrew as agreed to their own sector. They occupied Denmark. They drove further west into Germany than the agreed occupation lines, and they withdrew. He always stuck to the letter of whatever he finally agreed to after exhausting you with negotiations. Likewise, Stalin and the Soviets agreed 3 months after the surrender of Nazi Germany, we will go to war in the Pacific. And three months to the day after May 8th, 1945, they went to war, occupied Manchuria, and occupied the northern half of Korea, as well as some other territories. That's the history. Hitler was extremely anxious that Japan declare war on the Soviet Union, and there was an undeclared shooting war, especially before Pearl Harbor. And he, understandably, in his situation, felt a lot of resentment. He had declared war on the United States after Pearl Harbor, and he wanted Japan to do the same. They wouldn't. We weren't that anxious to have the Soviets involved in the Pacific either. And given the costs, I mean, this total death struggle with the Nazi war machine, the Soviets did not have many extra resources, to put it mildly, but at the end they did come in, not to just land grab. It's faded now, but you still hear it in American political rhetoric. Well, the Soviets went in there and just grabbed, you know, they took advantage, we were weak, and blah, 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 blah. You still hear echoes of that in the current Republican Party especially, but that was not the case. It was a specific Allied agreement.
And so, although to us the idea of a unified Korea, on the face of it, sort of feels ridiculous, or I mean, almost incomprehensible, and yet, in a sense, no. That would be sort of it would be a matter of, in a sense, reverting to what was the reality for 1,000 years. You're saying,
so. If it is unified, it won't be because the North Korean army has overcome the South. That's not going to happen. But because North Korea has finally collapsed, and they've seemed to be on the verge of collapse for many years now. Of course, they don't. The Chinese, the communist government in Beijing, is extremely worried about that possibility and will go to great lengths, I'm sure, to forestall that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will watch that with great interest.
And we should.
Particularly as these Olympic Games unfold, it will be really interesting to see what that looks like. And I don't know if you heard on Morning Edition today, but they did have a brief news report about how there actually have been some protests in South Korea over this, including it sounded like from conservatives in South Korea and many young people in South Korea who find it disconcerting that this olive branch is being extended, in a sense, to North Korea.
I've been going to South Korea since the mid-1980s. We'd built a large program on East Asia when I was at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. And I met South Koreans in the U.S. Army many years ago, extraordinary friends of this country. I mean, really, really dedicated to us. And there would be concern in the office because on the cover of Time magazine or on the news, there would be demonstrations in South Korea. Everything was fine. And as an American in South Korea, as in Britain, you are clearly a friend of that population.
Interesting.
And, we should go everywhere like our students. But if anybody's thinking of going to South Korea, please go. Don't worry about it. If you get tickets to the Olympics, that's great.
So let's talk for a moment about the U.S. economy and
which is not shutting down, fortunately.
Right. Well, certainly the stock market isn't. My word, it's sort of soared to record heights, which is something that President Trump is excited about and, of course, taking some responsibility for. And there are probably things that he has done that have certainly not hurt the stock market. I mean, including some facets of the tax reform bill that really are business friendly in terms of cutting corporate tax and so on, perhaps a sign of encouragement.
You better be careful. He may tweet about you.
Well,
maybe you'd like that.
Right. But no, not really. But but what is your sense of where we are in terms of the American economy, the nature of this recovery from, you know, the terrible situation we found ourselves in 8 or 9 years ago? Are we still just part of a slow march upward? How would you assess
this? Yes, we are. And we have a truly global economy, which means the scale is enormous. And one reason that the markets worldwide have been doing well. And it's important to stress that it's a global marketplace. Everyone almost has a stock market. Laos has a stock market, I learned a few years ago. Huh. I don't minimize the importance of that area and what they've gone through historically, mainly because of us, in my view. But Laos was not a country. It was a territory with a vaguely defined, cohesive, distinctive ethnically population. But they've got a stock market. It's just fantastic the way market economics is going around the world. There could be a crash. Who knows what's going to happen? Again, I'm the academic who's very good at discussing the past. But it does not have the characteristics of the bubble. It's going to go down. And I'm not recommending that anyone go into debt to buy stocks or, put the family in hock. But it does not yet have the characteristics of casino capitalism that that brought on the crash of 2007-08 and the much more modest dot-com crash. Speculation in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is very much gambling and speculation. And I do try to track the level of that activity, unless there's a gigantic black market in this junk that is so far invisible. And I think that's unlikely in today's system. It's not on the scale of, say, the derivatives, especially housing mortgage combined derivatives that the banking population bought wholesale and great volume and brought on the financial crash. So about a decade ago, we're not in that circumstance now.
So we don't see those same kind of dangerous activities, or at least not to the same extent.
Yeah, but you can't be complacent. You have to diversify. There is a wonderful book by Graham and Dodd called Security Analysis, which was first published in 1934. Benjamin Graham was this legendary Wall Street impresario who made money even during the 30s. Dodd was a Columbia business professor. It's been in print since 1934, and if you're really serious about investing, and when times are good is when you really have to be serious, I would urge people to study that. It takes discipline. It's rather monotonous. It's not like watching TV or playing with your portable device, but it's a good way to learn how to actually make money.
Mm-hmm. One other domestic matter to ask you about. And it takes us back to the matter of the government shutdown and the impasse in Congress. And, of course, the real sticking point would seem to be, as much as anything, over immigration policy.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, what if anything, we might do, for instance, with the DACA population.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, and I realize it's a complicated issue, but how do you think the whole issue of immigration and immigration policy needs to be approached? I mean, what are the factors that are most significant that need to be considered as?
Well, we have to stay mindful of the fact that I was talking about, the people who work for a living and are not at the top of institutions really taking it in the neck. The same goes for the immigrants, especially children and young people who were born here. They've really been double-crossed, in effect, by the system. President Obama took one approach. Obama and the Democrats during his two terms, and things have radically changed now with President Trump and the Republicans. I was very, very glad to hear Mitch McConnell on public radio early this morning talking about that being a priority, doing something sensible and responsible regarding them. But it's another case of haphazard federal policy really taking advantage of people. Now, they came here voluntarily. They weren't forced to immigrate to the United States, and there is a difference between legal and illegal immigration, but if we're anything, we should be a humane country, and those people are here because of economic demand, especially by corporations, but also by lots and lots of more regular Americans who want somebody else to do mow the lawn and do the yard work and take care of the other heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. In the closing minutes of our hour today, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the aforementioned radio legend Milton Rosenberg, who for many years, for decades, presided over one of the most intriguing radio programs anywhere, a late night program that aired on WGN. And this was a program on which you were an occasional guest. You want to make sure I say, but so Milton Rosenberg was somebody that you knew, and so first of all, just say a quick word about what it was like to be on his program, and what was that experience like?
He was invariably cerebral. He had very intelligent guests. We talked. And he really ran the gamut, not just politics, not much sports, although he covered the waterfront. He was very much interested in literary and artistic developments, including music, as we were discussing before we went on the air. He had a huge audience and a very impressive audience. It was a call-in program. And I was always impressed by the cerebral nature of the audience. And it was very much nationwide. And he was one of a series of impressive and influential public affairs people on the radio and television. John Calloway, unfortunately now deceased, who started out in public television in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Bruce Dumont, who fortunately is still with us and mm-hmm. has been a visitor to Carthage multiple times, the founder of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, who worked with Milt and with John Calloway early on. I think the newspaper tradition in Chicago has something to do with this. I did think about this after you mentioned it. You know, Chicago traditionally, when we had newspapers, was a newspaper town, very light, lively, active, irreverent, more earthy than New York, for instance, or the other eastern cities. WGN, world's greatest newspaper, Milt Rosenberg was based at the Tribune radio station until very late in his career. And that media emphasis in Chicago, I think, at some level, nurtured these very interesting characters, one of whom was Milt. He was a University of Chicago professor early in his career, which he understandably wanted us to emphasize. And that background, I think, made him a little different than other broadcasters.
Yeah. And, of course, he was renowned for being just about the most brilliant well-read man walking the face
polymath.
Of the earth.
A real polymath. One of the challenges at the Chicago Council, among many others, I spent 2 decades working there. We ran over 200 events a year with a small staff and had a constant need for speakers, and high-visibility people were important. We would pay honoraria, but not the gigantic fees that Henry Kissinger started demanding in the 70s, and then everybody started demanding. We would get authors on book tours, and I would spend a lot of time visiting publishers in New York and would come away with at least one copy of a good book. And invariably, they would bring up Milt Rosenberg. Oh, you're from Chicago. You must know Milt Rosenberg. He was a publisher's dream because when an author's on a book tour, the publisher pays the freight, and they're interested in maximum visibility, and he was distinctive. We finally got Henry Kissinger on a book tour, I'm proud to say, in the mid-90s when Diplomacy came out. But that really brought home to me just how influential he was and informed in serious circles.
Well, I was just noticing that if you go to a website, www.stitcher.com, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, Stitcher.com. It looks like there is an archive there where one can listen to Milt Rosenberg himself. I don't know if any of your visits to his program are part of that archive. I've yet to explore it, but I'd give anything to be able to hear
he
the two
of
you going.
Yeah, he was on every evening for many, many years.
So, well, I'm glad that that can be part of your resume as well, that you were across the table from Milt Rosenberg, who certainly will be missed.
I brought you the program from the memorial service at the University of Chicago Friday evening, and about 10 people spoke, and just going down it, you see the range of contacts and individuals that he had.
That's
religious,
very, very
secular. Yeah, it's a good symbol of just how far he reached. And he lived to the age of 92 and was working up until nearly the end.
Did something right. So, well, thank you for that remembrance. Thank you for this whole hour.
And, well, thank you.
Look forward to having you back in February. Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College joining us today on The Morning Show, as he does each and every month. It's always great to have you here. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. On Wednesday, the author of a fascinating book called The Written World, which sketches really the history of the emergence of literature and the way in which literature and our ability to write and to write down our stories and share them is really